Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we will be speaking with Raymond Garfield, chairman of Garfield Public Private. Ray is an industry legend with decades of experience, along with a history of delivering on nine-figure complex transactions. He reveals what scales and big deals, what doesn't, and how teams can adapt. With experience on the team that pioneered commercial mortgage-backed securities to running national-level capital markets groups, we take a journey through real estate history and finance, and we look at the power of public-private partnerships that few ever get access to. If you're a broker, investor, or developer, today's episode is well worth a listen. Ray, thank you for having on the podcast today.
Pleasure to be with you, Gordon.
So how do you get from being a naval aviator into the world of finance and real estate?
As old as I am, it's a pretty long story, but, my naval service was strictly going to the Naval Academy and then doing what all Naval Academy graduates do, and that served their country for some years after they graduate. Which I was proud to do as an aviator. And toward the end of my second tour, I injured a leg pretty badly, ended up in Bethesda Naval Hospital getting some surgery, and the docs telling me I couldn't fly and I couldn't go on board a ship because I couldn't climb ladders. So I had to figure out what my next career was going to be. And so I headed back to Texas, where I was from, and entered the civilian world.
And so in the civilian world, what got you into the world of real estate and finance? Because there's a lot of paths that you could have taken.
Well, I guess a little bit like you, my family had been in real estate for decades. My grandfather started his firm in the early 1900s. Uncle took over from him, and they were both had segments where they were president of the Texas Association of Realtors and involved in the National Association of Realtors. And so, I had an opportunity coming back to Dallas with my Naval Academy degree and my experience in the Navy. It's easy to find an interview because I think they figured I could walk and chew gum at the same time. So I was presented with a number of opportunities. One was to go into the aviation world, work with Ling, Temco, Vought, or one of the big manufacturers, had a friend in the insurance business, et cetera. I ended up spending 2 years with Ross Perot, Naval Academy graduate, when he was starting up his firm, EDS, Electronic Data Systems. I was traveling more for him than I was when I was deployed flying for the Navy. And my wife and my little kiddies wanted me to be home more. So that led me back to thinking about real estate, which back in the early 1970s was defined as local in nature. Well, little do we know, it's not local anymore. But back then it was. I was able to join a commercial real estate group. Spend my days and nights in Dallas, and not only working but being a good husband and father, and developing that family unit. And that really was it. I really didn't have any desire to to work for a family real estate business. By then, it was really managed by cousins and so forth. And so I took a different route, started in syndications, met land syndications, as a matter of fact, worked with some partners that were doing industrial buildings and retail buildings, but I liked the land business, and I started in North Dallas, and which is the way it grows, north, and was able to have some very successful syndications, built up a nice reputation, and by I think 1981 is when we were contacted by an executive recruiting firm that had been hired by Merrill Lynch of all companies to find an organization that could operate commercial real estate within their securities business. So our firm was purchased by Merrill Lynch in 1981, and that was really the first opportunity for me to make a giant leap from doing, you know, traditional commercial real estate, local real estate, listing properties, selling properties, et cetera. The first time I carried a Merrill Lynch card, there was a $100+ million building that was for sale or was going to be for sale in North Dallas, Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I couldn't get a meeting with him when my Garfield name was on the card. But when it was Merrill Lynch, he said, well, come on over and let's talk. So, you know, I found myself in a position of being able to all of a sudden do huge deals instead of small and modest sized deals, $1 million, $5 million deals, going to $50 to $100 million deals. And that was pretty intriguing and pretty exciting to me.
So what's the biggest difference between doing medium or small size deal and doing some of these larger deals when you're looking at it from the agent's perspective?
A bigger commission. You know, the basics are pretty much the same. And, you know, you underwrite the asset, you value it, you package it, you market it, you close it, and it just puts you into a different sphere of operating. So, you know, that was a great step. And I worked with Merrill Lynch for 4 years and found myself in New York with them, running the entire national group. And I don't think they'd mind me saying it at this time, but there was a time when they wanted to be all things to all people. And then as we had this national commercial real estate division, and we'd want to work with our corporate securities people, you know, we're having IPOs for major corporations and financings for major corporations. And when they had real estate needs, we really expected that in the brotherhood of the company, we'd be taken in and say, hey, you know, you guys want to sell this building, you want to buy a bigger building, you want to build a bigger building, whatever it is, our Merrill Lynch commercial real estate people can do this for you. And there was a real resistance. And I can appreciate it. I really can, because they worked for years developing these relationships on their own, doing certain disciplines for them. But they didn't understand real estate, and they were afraid we'd mess up a relationship that they had had for years. So I had lunch with a cousin of mine in New York, and he was in a building with Solomon Brothers. He was working for Oppenheimer. In fact, he was the fellow that redeveloped the St. Louis station in St. Louis when he was with Oppenheimer. But over lunch, he said, you know, Ray, If you know you don't want to stay with Merrill for much longer, I'd like to be with Solomon Brothers. You ought to go upstairs to see, meet these people and get to know them. So indeed, after lunch, I took the elevator back to Solomon Brothers Four, got off, asked who was responsible for real estate, and sat down and gave my card with my, you know, national manager, Merrill Lynch Commercial Real Estate, and it was intriguing enough for him to want to have a further conversation. Went to work for Solomon Brothers in the commercial real estate capital markets group. You may recognize the name Lou Ranieri, who and a lot of the Wall Street movies that were made 20 years ago was a guy that kind of got blamed for inventing commercial mortgage realty, real estate securities. But it was great because we did pioneer it. We were a very solid organization. Solomon Brothers was the king of Wall Street. And I got to participate in underwriting the first commercial mortgages in America. And work with the big trading floor, the largest trading floor on Wall Street at the time. The fellows that were on their phones talking to every insurance company in America, every bank institution, trust departments, et cetera, selling these securities. So it was a fast track, educational, process for me. Got my securities license. But basically, I was an investment banker. I was bringing in the clients who needed to capitalize or recapitalize their companies or their portfolios. So we were doing a couple of billion dollars a year in financing all over the country. Had a wonderful opportunity to go and for one of our American clients to Europe and do a Euro convertible. Financing for them. That was my going for my master's and my PhD in finance when I was there. And but for that, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. A quick step from there, I was recruited by the Rockefellers to run their Western United States for commercial real estate finance under the Cushman & Wakefield name when they owned it, and did that out of San Francisco. Interestingly enough, coincidentally, the recruiter that called me for Merrill Lynch back in 81 ended up in 89 calling me back in 90, I guess, and recruiting me for the CEO position of a company called Vista Properties, which was a spinoff, major spinoff of the largest mortgage company in America, Lomas and Nettleton, or Lomas Financial, went by both. And so I took these six subsidiaries out of bankruptcy in early 1992 and had the opportunity to shepherd a mess of a Chapter 11 restructuring, and try to guide about 14,000 shareholders. We were a publicly held company, and those shareholders and some very sophisticated bondholders, the likes of which were Equitable, I'm trying to think of some of the large holders, M Corp and those guys that owned a lot of our securities. Basically, we had to take a portion of a company. Lomas was the largest mortgage company in America, 75-year company, but they took their eye off the ball and they started getting into land acquisitions and development, and that's what took them under.
Yeah.
And so to let them out of Chapter 11, the plan was to, well, we'll take all the bad stuff, the bad bank, if you will. We'll couple all these companies together and we'll spin those out as a separate company. In Lomas and Nettleton, Lomas Financial, you can keep a 19% unconsolidated interest in this firm. The new board was, consisted of creditor representatives and equity representatives. And I got to be the chairman and meet them the first day that they all joined. And, and found our company with about $1.5 billion worth of built-in losses on the books. 10,000 acres across the country, Florida to California, literally, and no income, no revenue, ad valorem taxes to pay, but no income to pay them with. So I had to figure out, well, what's the least damage I can do in these first early years to at least be able to pay the taxes on the properties and keep them while we wait for that 1990s recession.
Can you talk about that a little bit? So, like, what I think is so interesting as someone who grew up fourth generation in commercial real estate is there's always these periods you go through where they're like, you know, as you mentioned, like, wait till 95. Or you know, I remember in 2008, people were saying, oh, just wait till like 2009, wait till 2010, we can survive. Or people would talk about during the COVID pandemic, you know, oh, if we just make it a couple years in the office market, we'll be all right. What was it like then? And then do you think that's just a mentality?
You know, it's really interesting because the first recession that I endured was the 73 to 75 recession. And that was when I had my first company, the one that got sold to Merrill Lynch in 1981. So my partners and I are really struggling through that that period of time. It ended in the mid 75, thankfully. And then there were some downturns along the way, 81, 82, you know, and then the 1990, 91 recession was deep. And you're right, the adage was stay alive until 95. So I took this company over in January of 92. Ernst & Young, the underwriters, accountants for the company, had estimated our land value at the time coming out of bankruptcy at about $350 million. Well, if you had to fire sale a land company in 1992, you know, you can know, just guess what you get for that portfolio. So, you know, I knew immediately that we were underwater, that we were probably valued at less than $100 million, truly, in our valuation of our land deals at that time, sitting on $1.5 billion worth of losses from the bankruptcy, right? And that was the great incentive, was to preserve those losses and then at the right moment in time sell the company to a white knight, another real estate company that was making a lot of money, that could see that they could shelter those gains with the losses that they'd acquire by acquiring our company. And there were tricks to it because we couldn't sell the company for at least 3 years. Federal law basically says if you sell more than 50% of a loss company in any three-year period, you'll limit the losses to $3 million. I got $1.5 billion, and I'm going, gosh, okay, so we can't do anything, right? And so I have a plan to guide this company out of the doldrums, the early 90s, into the mid-90s, benefit from an improving economy, preserve our most important assets, make sure we're an operating real estate company, because that's part of it too. I can't sell the company if I don't have an operating company. You know, if I'm valueless and only have losses, I've got to have real assets. So you'll appreciate this story. I had a vulture fund representative come to see me in Dallas. And my first month as the new CEO of Vista Properties. And he sat down across from me, and I'm sure he's New York to Dallas, and he's going, I got this A seed that's running this company, and I'll walk all over him. And he said, Mr. Garfield, I want you to sell the company immediately. Well, he had bought his interest in the company from the old creditors of Lomas. So at the exit of bankruptcy, there were these secure those bonds that were issued to the old creditors. And the bonds were structured beautifully for me as a captain of a company, because I didn't have to pay any interest on them if I didn't have the money to pay it. I just issued more bonds to them. So they start off, you know, holding, well, the bonds were probably in the $300 million range. And they think that's what it is. They think I can sell the company for $350 million and but they had purchased their bonds at the exit from bankruptcy from these old creditors for probably 10 cents on the dollar. They probably paid 30 or 40 million for it, right? They have 300 million in bonds. They paid $30 million for them. So they're thinking they're going to make a killing. He was very disappointed to hear that we couldn't sell the company for any more than what he'd probably paid for those bonds. And it infuriated him. And he just said, well, ultimately we'll take care of you, Garfield. You can't do this to us. But we proceeded to run this company for the next 3 years, hire some of the great lawyers in the country, securities attorneys, real estate attorneys, bankruptcy attorneys, et cetera, and understood the laws and developed a plan to market the company to really capable, profitable real estate firms. So we ended up in 1995 or maybe early 96 getting an offer to sell the company by Syntex Corporation, which under Pulte was the next biggest home builder in America, headquartered in Dallas, which was nice because that's where we were. And they came in and they underwrote our company for about 6 months, studying everything. And they made this offer. And then, fortuitously, another company came in. I won't mention their name, but they're one of the largest developers in America as well. And they sent three people out of their headquarters in Florida up to see us. They entered our offices on a Monday morning and promptly asked my CFO, my chief financial officer, who was a woman, by the way, to go get them coffee. And right there, any chance of a cordial relationship was probably shot. Well, yeah. So they spent 3 days underwriting the company. And on the strength of Syntex's offer, this company decided they must know what they're doing. So they offered $1 million more than Syntex did. And then back and forth for several months, each company continued to overbid to purchase our company, which was very nice for our shareholders and our creditors. So, long story short is, Syntex was the ultimate winner. They acquired our company. It was very, very successful for them. Their stock grew from, I think, $15 a share in 1996 to probably $60 or $70 a share by, you know, 1998. All the taxes that they were paying to the government were being sheltered. So they were plowing that money back into home building and everything else. It was a great tool for operating and building a company. So, but I was out of a job. I interviewed several companies and I got issued some nice offers to become a number two or number three person in these other companies. After being the number one person in a company, and at my age, I said, no, I'd just rather do something myself. So
what do you think is the big difference then between being the number one at a company and being in a supporting role?
Well, I think it really was the age issue. I mean, if I had been 35 years old again at that time instead of 55 or whatever I was, I probably would have jumped at the chance to be a number two at a larger, very successful company. But at that time, I really felt like I had learned so much along the way that that I could develop, you know, a successful organization. And I know you can appreciate that working in your company, which is a family, you know, business. Two of my boys work for me, and if my younger son, who's the president of the company, heard me say that, he'd be throwing rocks at me. Because he can't wait for me to retire. But, you know, I think that it was just, maybe it was an ego thing with me, but maybe it was an age deal with me. I just wanted to do my own thing. So, and I knew that I could do a couple of things very quickly. And the thing that led us to develop Garfield Public Private, the foundation of which began in January 1997, right after we had finished our merger and a sale with Syntex. One of my board members, and our advertising and public relations firm interviewed me some months ago about mentors. And so one of my great mentors was a fellow by the name of Bud Gravett. Bud had been chairman of the Bowery Savings Bank in New York. Before that, he was chairman of two or three public companies, hugely successful businessman, hugely successful. And he had been on the board of Turner Construction, America's largest commercial construction firm, for 14 years. And they had an issue in 1996 that similar to kind of what Lomas was going through back in the late 80s. The largest commercial builder in America had started getting into development. And if they were building a high-rise tower for Jerry Hines, and there was an extra piece of land next door where they could build an apartment building, you know, okay, Turner to do that. And so by the end of mid-90s, if you will, it had hurt them badly. They just had a lot of Class B and C commercial type development properties, but their base business was building bricks and mortar for these major developers around the country. So Bud Gravett, at the end of 96, during a board meeting, was pulled aside by his fellow board members, and they said, "Bud, if you'll be the new chairman, we're going to ask the existing chairman to take a hike." And so in an hour's time, he went from being a board member to being the chairman and CEO of Turner. And we had developed such a nice relationship during the 4 years that we were board members at Vista. He called me and he said, "My first important job is to get rid of Turner Development Corporation." And he said, "Ray, if you're interested," I mean, because he wanted to know what I was going to be doing. And I said, "I'm going to start my little company." He said, "Well, I'd like to hire half of your year and you work on selling Turner Development Corporation." So that was great because it was sort of that first step into the next venture. So at the end of 97, we'd sold Turner Development Corporation. And Bud very nicely invited me back to New York and sat me down and said, "Great job, Ray. Now I got a new job for you." And he said, "You know, we've been developing buildings for 100 years. And of course, we develop for lots of private developers, so I don't want to threaten any of those guys. But we build a lot of things for the public sector. We build for the federal government. We build for cities, counties, states, et cetera. Those jobs, private developers aren't interested in. So, and those are the program, Gordon, at the time, was that to win a job with the public sector, you had to be the low bidder. Remember, they're trying to protect the taxpayers' money. So they put out a request for proposals to architects if they needed a new school or they needed a new airport or they needed a new courthouse or whatever the building was going to be. You hire an architect He designs the entire deal. Then you take the designs, and then you have another RFP, but for contractors. And so, and that's just, you give them these plans that have now been worked on for a year by the architect, and you say, bid these plans, and they know that they have to be the low bidder in order to be selected. And over the years, it had become such a slipshod business that you couldn't depend upon the guaranteed maximum price or the schedule, because if you know how complex plans are, building from the soils, the foundations, you know, the superstructures, the MEP, the civil, everything that goes into these buildings. You put those plans in front of a contractor and say, get your estimators to look at these plans, and in the next 45 to 60 days, come back with a price and a schedule. You can't do it, but they did it, and therefore you build in contingent. The contractors build in contingencies. They expect tons of change orders, and that's the way the projects went. And I think I mentioned to you that I hadn't heard the term when I was talking to Bud in his offices in New York. But he says, you know, that process is known as design, bid, build, litigate, and then occupy. And so he said, there's a new approach to doing this business, which is design, build. We want to do more of it. We've done 4 design, build properties in the last 4 years. Our margins have been 2 to 3 times what they are if we're doing these bid jobs. I want to do more. I only want to do them with my best offices. They had 44 offices, of course, at the time. They got more now. But he said, I just want the offices I can depend upon. But if you can win these design build jobs early on, when they're first put out for bid, you put a team together, which includes the contractor and the architect and subcontractors, interior design folks, everything you can imagine. And you start from your concept plans, working through schematic plans, working through DDs, design documents, working through construction documents. That's a year process in these $100 million deals. And if the contractor's there at the table with the architect and the engineers all the way along, they're resolving all the conflicts. So then when they bid the job and give a guaranteed maximum price, it can be relied upon. The schedule can be relied upon. And by the way, it's riskier for the contractor because he's taking more reins, all the reins of responsibility, and therefore the liability is there. So they do make a bigger margin in their profits, and they take more risk. They should get more return. And so we developed that program beginning in early 1998. And over the next 4 years that we were retained, I didn't work for Turner. I was retained. I was on a retainer by Turner because they didn't want an analyst from Wall Street to come back in and find they were still in the development business. So, you know, we were retained as the design, build, finance, operate company for them, and to support their marketing people across the country and going out and bidding for and winning public sector jobs. Again, not threatening all the great developers in the country with what they do for a living. We looked at building buildings for cities, counties, state agencies, airport authorities, college campuses, healthcare campuses, et cetera. And so, you know, we did about $600 million worth of business in those 4 years with Turner collaboratively. And so by, I guess, 2002 or 3, whenever that was, when Turner, and Turner had some great success with their stock, because once they got rid of the development company and things that were albatrosses around their neck, they soared, and their stock went from the American Exchange to the New York Exchange, and they were purchased by a German company, And I guess the rest is history. They're still the largest general builder in America and a great firm. My mentor, Bud, when the new ownership arrived, retired, along with my retainer. So thankfully, we'd been able to meet other contractors, other architects, engineering firms, hotel brands and operators, convention center operators, et cetera. So that at least in 2002, when our retainer program was gone with Turner, we were able to continue and grow the country and grow the company.
So why do you think it's so hard then? I mean, it seems like you guys have a pretty good method that you established, but why do you think it's still so hard for us to build public infrastructure in the U.S.? Because private development deals, we've done a lot of them. We've done some public, but mostly 99.9% of our deals have been private. It's hard, but it's not, it's not rocket science. Why is public infrastructure so difficult to build?
Politics, probably one of the big explanations for it. I can't win a job in Dallas to save my soul, but I'm here. Literally the first 7 years of my company's existence, I didn't win a deal in Texas. I had to be viewed as the expert from afar. I'd go to New York to do the Department of Transportation headquarters, and I was with Turner, and they'd say, well, I've never heard of Garfield, but he's with Turner. He must be okay. And so, and he's from Texas. He's probably pretty smart now. So big turnaround from that vulture guy that came to see me when I was running Vista. That was it. You're never a prophet in your own land. So those early years, it was very difficult for us to do anything in Texas because our name wasn't Gerald Hines. It wasn't Trammell Crow. And those are the names they knew. And Ray Garfield, I haven't heard of you, Ray, so be off with you. So around 2007, we won a job in Lubbock, Texas, with Texas Tech and the city of Lubbock to develop a headquarters hotel and conference center for both the city and Texas Tech. And so that was our first Texas victory. And it's led to probably another maybe $1 billion worth of development here in Texas. Yet we still are developing across the country. That's really important to know, is that, mayors, city managers, city councils are not experts in these areas. They're very tentative in what they do. They're very subject to being influenced by their friends and advisors within that community that they've known for years. And for us to come in with a new approach to things can shock them to their core. And we know we don't have an opportunity to move forward there. I mean, we went to Atlanta, Georgia for Turner in the early 2000s when they had almost a 50-year-old courthouse with no security. Shortly after the Murrah bombing in Oklahoma City, they just were panicked that they needed a new and secure courthouse. But the mayor had told them that they would not put a referendum before the public to approve the bonds to build a new courthouse for at least 4 years. Their current bond referendum, which was coming up in about a year, was already about $1 billion, and they just didn't want to jeopardize the results of that election by making it even bigger. So they told the judges in the courthouse, you're going to have to wait. So we came in and we created one of the first public-private developments for a courthouse in America. We suggested that the city lease this building, and use revenues from their fines and forfeitures in Atlanta, which at that time, it's a big city, were $25 million a year in fines and forfeiture revenues. Different from ad valorem taxes, right? Different from all the taxes that come into the general fund. So if we could use those funds so that the city could enter into a 30-year lease with the lease payments coming from those fines and forfeiture revenues, we could avoid a public referendum. It's exactly what we did. And we used a state agency, the Georgia Municipal Corporation, to nominally act as the owner of the courthouse for the years that it had the mortgage on it. The city was the tenant. Their own state agency was the owner, and the state agency promised to give them the property back when the mortgage was fully amortized. We could use tax-exempt bonds at almost the same rate that Atlanta would have to sell a general obligation bond at that time. So close, about 3 basis points is all. And so it made so much sense. Did it design build, finished it ahead of schedule and under budget, and was just hugely successful. And that model is what we took to New York to do the Department of Transportation headquarters building, and to Reno, Nevada to do their public safety training campus and others. It wasn't until 2007, well, I'll take that back. You know, our first hotel was in 2003 when we delivered the Sheraton Overland Park Convention Center and Hotel in Overland Park, Kansas, which was the third tax-exempt hotel that was done in America. And that really opened the doors for us to do more convention centers with their headquarters hotels around the nation. We had an opportunity around 2005, I guess, to go to Durham, North Carolina, and help them plan to develop a new performing arts center, the DPAC, the Durham Performing Arts Center, DPAC, which has been one of the most successful performing arts centers in America since it opened around 2008, I think. And again, public-private, some public bonds amortized by hotel occupancy taxes to the city, contributions from foundations and corporations, naming rights, pouring rights, et cetera, that came in to help on the private side of things. So you merge public investment that they think is all they have to invest is X amount of dollars, but it's going to cost Y. So you take that, and then you put the other private capital in, and you merge them into this public-private model.
What's the key to like effectively accomplishing the public-private model? Because I know that we've worked with companies that have struggled in the past to do that. So I'm just curious, how have you been particularly successful at merging the public sector and the private sector?
I think trust is a huge part of it. Education and information is a huge part of it. If they know that you've had some success in the past and you've got a good reputation and your past clients are saying these guys did a great job for us, and they listen, and we encourage them, bring in your financial advisors, bring in your bond counsels. We want them sitting at the table with you listening as we're talking through this. This is not, your everyday walk in the park. You know, this is pretty much kind of like rocket science for these guys. And so I think that trust and verify approach is terribly important. So I'm really proud of the fact that we have a great reputation, that they know we're a fiduciary for them. That's a big difference for us. We're a public-private development firm. We're not a private developer that puts our own equity and our friends' money at risk. That's good and that's bad. It's bad in that 50 years from now, my grandkids and their kids won't be inheriting the billion-dollar fortune that I built up. Okay, that's the bad part of it. The good part of it is I can literally sell to these clients the fact that I am a fiduciary for them, just like their trusted attorneys and accountants and advisors. And I bring this, you know, our firm brings this capital markets experience and knowledge of decades. We understand the bond markets. You understand that almost everything we do is tax exempt. What that means is if we build a hotel, and this is, we have to have this dialogue with the city. We developed and delivered in 2019, the Irving Weston Hotel, Weston Irving Convention Center Headquarters Hotel in Irving, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, in Las Colinas, one of the most successful business parks in America, home to like 40 of the Fortune 500 companies. They had built their beautiful convention center and opened it in 2011 with no hotel. And they couldn't develop group business without that headquarters hotel. They had started to hire hotel developers in 2001 and did that until 2013. And five developers failed. And in 2016, when that fifth developer failed, they were beside themselves and they said, we got to do this. What's going wrong? And so we had the opportunity to suggest to them that they had never understood the capital structure of a world-class four-star headquarters hotel for a convention center. It costs so much more than any limited or select service hotel. Therefore, the city, for that one hotel, needed to make an investment. Either that, or if they did it the old way, they'd hire a private developer and they'd give him a subsidy. So the private developer, if it was you or me and in our private real estate world, we'd underwrite the hotel and say, we got to have a 20 or 25% internal rate of return on our equity. So that's the first hurdle. Second hurdle is we got to go find a bank that's going to loan us some money. And these days they're loaning money at 8 or 9 or 10%. That's half the cost of the hotel. So half the cost is at 8 or 10%. Another 20% is at 25%. And then they've got to put in the subsidy. So if they do that, all of a sudden you're amortizing this hotel at a double-digit figure. Your mortgages are in double-digit, 12, 13, 14% when you blend it all together. But if they do this one hotel to support their tourism business, their group business, or their convention center, they can set up a not-for-profit, and that hotel can be financed without a bank, without equity. So all the bonds are tax exempt. The last three hotels that we opened in the last 24 months were capitalized in 2021, just before the Fed started increasing its rates. And those bonds were issued somewhere between 3 and 4.5%. 3 and 4.5% for the total capital obligation for a hotel versus double digit figures. And if you can explain to the city that if you just think about this as an investment, that subsidy that you'd give to the private guy, and he gets all the cash flow and he gets the residual ownership. But if you convert that subsidy into an equity into your own not-for-profit, so if you're going to give him $35 million, like Irving gave their not-for-profit, versus giving $35 million to Garfield as a private developer, that's gone. Now Irving owns that hotel. Ultimately, they don't own it yet. Their $35 million gives them ownership of the ballroom and the boardrooms and the meeting spaces. And the hotel tower is owned by the not-for-profit, keeping that mortgage off the books. But when that mortgage is amortized, the hotel and all the space is owned by the city. So you have double impact positively to the city. You have much lower interest rate. The city gets all excess cash flows after paying the mortgage. And then when the mortgage is fully paid, it gets all the value of that hotel at the end of the day. if they can listen to that and understand it, that's part of the answer to your question, is how do you get these things done? There's got to be a level of trust, understanding, commitment. It certainly has to be it's got to be a very important piece of real estate that they need. It's got to be a new courthouse like Atlanta if the old one's not safe. It's got to be a convention center and headquarters hotel if there's no group business in that community. That's an important piece of business to bring into a city. If they don't have a performing arts center, they don't have an art support for their population, they can basically get through that thought process to say, this is important.
Let's dig into that. So, just for anybody who's in a private developer, the advantage to have, you know, a massive financing advantage in a low liquidity environment is tremendous, right? But
yes.
How do you access that ability? What's the standard that allows municipalities to save on these sort of projects? And like, what kind of projects does this apply to?
Well, there are these two different kinds of projects. They're the publicly occupied buildings, the courthouses, the city halls, the libraries, fire stations, all of that kind of stuff, where the community, whether it's the city or the county or state agencies, are occupying an office building, where they're the tenant. That's kind of easy pickings, if you will, because they got to have a building to operate in. They got to pay either a mortgage or a lease on that building. So you can justify that. The trickier thing things are things like performing arts centers, museums, arenas, event centers, hotels, convention centers. All, and there's that segment of that business, whether it's cultural arts or whether it's association convention group business. I mean, think about the massive amounts of spending and tax revenues for a city like Las Vegas for what it does in terms of convention business, right? They've got all the casinos, of course, but it's a city everybody loves to go to if their particular association or group is having a convention there. They'll jump at that chance where they won't go to Tucumcari. But that revenue, think of it this way too. In Irving, where we didn't have a hotel, the city of Irving was making about $20 to $30 a day in revenue spent by people that would come to a day event at the convention center and not spend a night and not have a big meal. They'd stop through McDonald's for a soda. And once we opened that hotel, that $20 to $30 a day went to $300 to $400 a day. Because the hotel's probably $250 to $300 a night now, maybe more in packed days. But, you know, people are having banquets. They're having, you know, full meals, et cetera. They're going to retail stores or shows or whatever it is while they're there. That spending is the best kind of tax money that a city can have coming into it. Because these people are there for a short time. There's not the police and the fire and all of that stuff that it's there on standby, but not to support the entire citywide, you know, residential market and retail market. So it's great new revenue for them. So they have to justify that. They have to think through that. You know, do we want this for our city? Can we afford not to have it for our city? And if, you know, we're working with a couple of cities right now. We're designing new hotel and convention centers. And it's not just for that visit XYZ city or the XYZ Convention and Visitors Bureau. That new hotel is going to be a full-service hotel with ballrooms and banquet rooms and meeting rooms and all of the bells and whistles that you got. So you're going to have your graduations there. You're going to have weddings there. It's going to serve the community as well as it's going to bring these 2- and 3- and 4-day events in the city. It's just a fundamental, essential program property, if you will, that is needed by almost every important city in America. When I say important, it can be New York City, or it can be Irving, Texas. They're in different regions. They do different things, but they have communities and they need to support their population.
So, one of the things that we'll get into is we'll get into our final four. It's a nice way to wrap everything up and a nice way to dig in a little bit more to your experience particularly your experience in financing real estate deals, which I think, you know, anybody who's listened to this podcast, it's unquestioned, right? So what do you think is going to have changed the most 10 years from now about how we finance real estate deals?
Well, I think we're already seeing the changes with AI. So artificial intelligence is going to technologically streamline the underwriting of financing and mortgage models and financial models in the future. One thing that I've run up against, and you're going to run up against it, if not already, is that we're going to see climate change impacting capitalization and frankly, the expenses on properties. We built a hotel on the coast, and you know the insurance on that hotel is in excess of $1 million a year, and on all of our other inland hotels, it's $300,000 a year. I mean, you know, those things I think are gonna change. I think that. Our economy has grown so fast and is so dynamic. I feel like maybe more people will not be able to afford their homes in the future. I think rental properties are going to increase in demand, whether it's a residential sort of single family build to rent facilities, you know, in communities. There's going into that world. But I think basically, that the technological sort of AI powered efficiencies are going to be doing that. And frankly, you know, I think there's going to be maybe potentially more use of variable rate mortgages as well. You know, I went through these swings in interest rates during my 1970s, 80s, et cetera. Yeah. The early 80s, the 80s were horrible. You know, 16-17% mortgage, 18% mortgages, instead of 7-8% mortgages. People don't realize what those were. But really, I guess, you know, starting in 2010 or whatever it is, we had a very stable interest rate market. I mean, interest rates hardly changed, you know. COVID, they sank to the bottom, but they were never more than a couple of percent. And in terms of Fed fund rates, and so that stability or the lack of variability, and that I think is something that that maybe will be utilized more in the future. So I think the use of adjustable rate mortgages for residential, or you know, we financed a couple of major buildings using variable rate structures, letter of credit bank. Mortgages with a bank letter of credit guaranteeing the principal, but interest rates in the 1-2% range when they were 5 fixed made some sense, and we had to have confidence that the interest rate would remain at that low level and not all of a sudden spike up, because that's the danger, of course, of a variable rate mortgage. So I think that'll be part of the difference as well.
So one of the things that we like to do besides looking forward is we like to look back. That's why we love getting voices like yourself on the podcast that have had a long career and a successful career. And one of the ways that you know, we like to look back is look back at when we were starting out. We have some younger listeners, and if you could give them one bit of advice, if they're starting out in the industry, what would it be?
Well, if I had it to do over again, there's one football game that I played in against the Marine Corps that I'd definitely not play in again because that ended up getting ending my Navy career. So if you can, you know, play golf or tennis or something that's less dangerous than the real physical contact sports. I trust your own instincts if they're good. I had perhaps one experience along the way where I was more tempted by the offer, the financial offer, in terms of working for an individual that was just and turns out to almost be an insane individual. And, you know, that was a 6-month, period of my life that, I'd like not to do over again. I went from where I was to there and back to where I was in a 6-month period of time, and just shaking my head going, that was just a mistake. I didn't need the money that bad. I don't think I would change much in my life or in my career. You know, I mean, I met the perfect woman at an early age. We've been married for 58 years. She has just been a wonderful life in that sense. I have 3 great kids. They're all happily married with families and all that stuff. I've got a couple of my sons that work in the company with me, which is fun, but I've got a lot of other good friends that work in the firm as well. So we have a collegial environment that we work in and we like. So I think it's just certainly evaluate what you really think is going to interest you and excite you. As I got out of the Navy and I interviewed at Lean Tempo Vought and I interviewed at Mutual of New York and these other, you know, different industries, going, you know, can I do this well? Can I succeed in it? I think I made the right decision in terms of joining a small real estate company and sitting next to the principal, listening to him make phone calls and learning how to find properties and list properties and syndicate properties and all of that. But each one of these experiences is a stepping stone. You know, when you've exhausted those opportunities, made the most of those opportunities, look for the next challenge, and don't be shy about going out and grabbing it.
So one of the things we always like to go out and grab is a new book. I'm an avid reader I'm curious, what's the next book our podcast listeners should pick up?
Well, you know, I have varied reading likes and dislikes. You know, from a when I was running Cushman & Wakefield's Western Region, I had a couple of individuals that were just hard cases that worked for me, and I asked a friend of mine about approach. He said, "Well, grab Nirenberg's book, which is getting through to people." And so I was able to pick up Getting Through to People and look through and read all of these personality traits and tics and all of that kind of stuff, and it was great help. And so I've got a part of my library is dealing with the psychological approach to leadership. I learned early on in my first 2 years with Perot how to interview, how to evaluate, and pick out the cream of the crop. And that's always been helpful to me in each of these steps. I've been able to recruit really solid talent. You know, people that, if you look at their history, you just look at the resume. If they've had 5 jobs in 10 years, you don't want them. Okay? You want to see purpose and direction and stability. And if someone does leave a job for another job, asking them, why did you decide to leave? And why did you go here and everything else? But the achievements, whether from high school to college, to military to business, looking for, Perot used to say that eagles don't flock, you got to find them one at a time. And so that was important. But I also read, I read Korda's Power, which is a great book as well. So that's why I always have little small stools in front of my desk, so people are way sitting below me and I can I can intimidate them when I'm sitting over them. No, but, those sorts of books that have resonated from a business sense. But frankly, I'm kind of like you. I mean, if you look at my library, and you'll know I'm in the military, ironically, as an aviator, I have more submarine books in my library than I have anything to do with aviation. It just fascinated me. But, I love The Great Santini as a book. It was a great movie too, but what a great book it was. Webb at the Naval Academy wrote his first book, was A Sense of Honor, and it was written, he was 2 classes behind me at the academy and really resonated with me. It was a great book, kind of like The Lords of Discipline, if you ever read that book or saw the movie. I kind of like time travel. I've always enjoyed Shakespeare and Sherlock Holmes and that stuff. But there was a great book called, I think, From Time to Time, that author by the name of Jack Finney wrote. So there's a lot of when you get away from it all, you take a break, go down to the beach, sit down, read a book or two. It's just a great way to unwind.
The one way that we always like to kind of unwind is the final 2 questions. And the last of the final 4 questions that we like to do is, and this is the one we won't let you get away with. This is like the question of the whole reason why we started the podcast is, who's the next person who's influencing the world of real estate that we should have on?
I've really tried to think of a good answer for that each time I'm asked the question. Since my great mentor Bud Gravett passed away, he'd be the ideal guy to interview. I think there are some captains of industry that are out there. There's certainly some fine real estate firms, much better known than Garfield Public Private, to look for the leaders in those areas. I just think that these days I probably maybe it's the reason when I was playing golf, and I haven't played golf for about 10 years now, but I used to play a lot of golf. And I never had a business meeting on a golf course. And everybody thought I was crazy. I just wanted to go out with friends. When I go fishing, I want to go out with friends and not think about anything. So the great part about fishing is that you don't think about anything. You just sit there and look at the water and look at the fish and just soak it in. And so I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't think I do. I love the guys I work with. I think that Greg Garfield, who's the president of our company, is maybe one of the sharpest individuals in understanding cultural arts in America. He developed the Durham Performing Arts Center. He developed the Eccles Theater in Salt Lake, Utah. He developed the Buddy Holly Hall in Lubbock. He's just learn his craft and everything else. So when you talk about gaining appreciation for that, just that segment of the world of entertainment and promotion and those things. That's the one thing I think you're going to fail me on in terms of having me recommend who you
should. We can reach out to Mr. Garfield. That's fine. In terms of just generally, there's one final question that we always love to ask. And it's just, what's the best way for someone to get in contact with you to learn more about what you guys do and to learn a little bit more about you?
Well, thank you, Gordon, for asking that. I guess maybe the simplest way for folks around the country is our website, which is www.garfieldpublicprivate.com. And that gives them the opportunity to not only see kind of what we've done over the years, but it's got the contact information and everything else. We're in Dallas, we're so mobile because we're working literally coast to coast, on these public job fronts, Anyway, anybody like to reach out? You know, probably 80% of the work that we do, Gordon, is referred business. I mean, a deal comes across our desk. It's typically sent to us by Hyatt or Hilton or Marriott or ASM or OVG, the big managers of these convention centers and arenas, or it's referred to us by one of these contractors. We deal with 10 to 15%. Of the top 100 to 200 architects and contractors that are listed by Engineering and News Record, ENR's top 400, top 500, take the top 100 or 200. That's where the firms that we have dealt with over the years reside. So any day we could get a call from an architect like Gensler to say, hey, we've got a client that wants to do XYZ. Or somebody might, whether Turner Construction Company may call and say, hey, this city, is trying to do something and they can't do a vote. So that's where most of our stuff really comes from, because they're going to be on a team with us. They'll make money and we can make money. So, any of these folks, I'd love to have anybody reach out and talk to us.
Great. Thank you so much for hopping on the podcast, and we'd love to have you on the future.
Thanks very much, Gordon. Great to talk to you, too. You have a great day, okay?
Thanks again to Ray. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanford of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.